Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum, your weekly dose of science and technology from DW in Bonn, Germany. I'm Nicole Gubel, your host this week.
Today we have a lot of strawberries from Italy and Spain. Also we get the first asparagus from Germany. Then we have a lot of oranges and mandarins.
How leftover fruit and veg from a market in Stuttgart could end up powering the city's cars. Also coming up on the show.
One idea is to disrupt a bit what's happening, to challenge people to think different, do something that will change their way of thinking.
He's the first artist in residence at CERN in Geneva, and he's determined to turn particle physics into art. That's coming up a little later in the show, but first...
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
When it comes to fighting crime, authorities walk a tightrope between useful and acceptable methods to ascertain people's whereabouts and movements and privacy. In France, the government is in the process of creating a massive database of biometric passport holders. The initiative is known as the Honest People's File. Potentially, all French citizens could appear on it. The last time France tried something similar, albeit not digital, was during the Second World War. Rights groups say the initiative clearly infringes on civil liberties and want the project scrapped. In a landmark ruling, France's highest court banned police from using the database, but it stopped short of having the file destroyed. Clea Corcut reports from Paris.
It's a victory for French civil liberties groups, but only a very small victory, and almost certainly a temporary one. France is creating a massive database of biometric ID holders, but won't be able to use it. Last month, Parliament passed legislation allowing data contained on biometric ID cards to be centralised to combat ID fraud. But France's top court, the Constitutional Council, has ruled the database infringes civil liberties and as a result has banned the police from using it. Jean-Claude Vitron, an activist with the NGO League of Human Rights, welcomes the court's ruling, but says he has reservations.
We're happy that parts of the law have been rejected. That was our main objective. But we're disappointed the court did not reject the entire law.
Vitron says the database known as the Honest People's File is still a threat.
We're still concerned because they're creating a centralized file about French citizens. Even if the police can't use it now, they might be able to use it in the future. That's a big problem.
Last December, the French government introduced new biometric ID cards to combat ID theft. The biometric data on the cards includes the holder's name, surname, place of residence, height, eye colour, photos and two fingerprints of the holder. It's this information that will be fed into the database. Senator Jean-René Le Ser is one of the authors of the controversial law and explains why he thinks it's necessary.
Nous avons constaté que l'usurpation d'identité était une infraction qui était en plein développement, et ça, je crois que tout le monde l'a reconnu.
We've seen ID fraud growing in France, and I think my fellow lawmakers understand this too. We've now become aware of the way victims of ID fraud suffer. If someone steals your identity, you lose your bank account, can't leave France, and if the thief commits a felony, you pay the price.
Vous ne pouvez plus sortir du territoire. On commet des infractions, c'est vous qui en payez les conséquences.
Official figures about ID fraud in France vary greatly. But it's thought there are between 10,000 to 200,000 cases per year. But security isn't the only issue. Rights groups say centralizing biometric data presents a serious threat to civil liberties in France, a country which they say already holds too many databases. According to a parliamentary report from 2009, French police have over 50 different databases at their fingertips. Jean-Marc Ménac, a journalist for the online news portal OVNI, explains the French fascination with digital databases.
Because it's possible. If it's technically possible, why can't you create it? So that's the first thing. Another thing, it's after 9/11, everything possible must be done to fight terrorism and thus crime, even if it's illegal.
Menac also claims lawmakers have been biased in favour of French biometric companies during hearings about the database.
The parliament asked 30 people to come to parliament and explain if it's a good idea or not. 14 of those people were manufacturers, because France is the number one country for those technologies. Of the five companies that leads electronic ID card and biometrics, three are French companies.
Senator Le Serre rejects the accusation that the Honest People's File will sacrifice civil liberties to further the economic interests of French biometric businesses. But he does admit to having helped French firms.
C'était certainement pas l'objectif premier, mais si ça pouvait être une conséquence supplémentaire, je crois que cette conséquence, elle...
It was not our main objective, but I don't think Parliament was opposed to supporting our industries. French firms have long been leaders in the field of biometric technology, but we are so backward in our use of it that these businesses have been forced to work in the United States, Brazil or emerging countries.
Travailler pour les États-Unis, pour le Brésil, pour les pays émergents.
French rights groups say they will continue their campaign to have the database scrapped and are calling for a public debate on the use of biometric technology. And in the run-up to the 2012 presidential elections, the French Socialist Party has pledged it will re-examine the law if it wins. Clea Corkett, DW, Paris.
While the issue of civil liberties divides people, and not just in France, using fingerprint technology to detect drug use or handling may not be quite as controversial. And UK scientists connected to the University of East Anglia hope to make that possible in the very near future. Sweat is the key ingredient here. A handheld device detects traces of drugs like cocaine, cannabis, methadone and heroin. It can even tell whether you've had a sneaky smoke. I spoke to Paul Yates from Intelligent Fingerprinting, the company behind the new technology. I started by asking him how the new technology works.
The intelligent fingerprinting technique works by analysing the tiny amounts of sweat that are left behind in our fingerprints whenever we touch anything. Now, sweat testing is not new, but what's unique about the intelligent fingerprinting method is that we're able to use that sweat both to develop a high-definition image of the fingerprint that can be used for identification purposes, such as people be familiar with from TV programmes like CSI New York. But also we can use the chemicals to tell us something about the lifestyle of the individual. Now, what I mean by lifestyle, if we use smoking as an example, people smoke because of the addictive qualities of the drugs in the cigarettes called nicotine. Now, when nicotine goes into the body of the smoker, it's metabolized or changed within the body into a second drug called cotinine. And that drug goes out into the body and comes out in the body fluids, the saliva, and also comes out in the sweat in the fingerprints. Now, using the intelligent fingerprinting method, we tested a random selection of people, some of whom were smokers and some of whom weren't, and looked for traces of this drug cotinine in their fingerprint sweat. And we only detected it in the fingerprint sweat of the people that were smokers. So you can use that to tell you something about the lifestyle, in this case, that the person is a smoker.
How can the device tell the difference between whether you've been handling the drug and actually taking it? If you could tell us a bit more about that.
Some of the other ways of detecting drugs or drug use in an individual, there's sometimes a problem that you can just get what's called a false positive by picking up detection of the drug itself by innocent contamination. Now, the intelligent fingerprinting technique works by analysing the metabolites of the ingestion of the drug. So that's the way the body has actually changed the drug as it's been metabolised by their body. So this means, for example, you couldn't get a false positive from somebody, say, touching a surface that had some drug on it and then testing their fingerprint. The technique also picks up the metabolites in direct correlation to the fingerprint sweat pores themselves. So we can see the metabolites, the product of the ingestion of the drug, actually coming out of the fingerprint sweat pores themselves. So again, you couldn't get a false positive by, for example, shaking hands with somebody who was a drug user and picking up their sweat, because you wouldn't see that direct correlation of the metabolites with the own individual's fingerprint sweat pores.
Now, you've recently secured new investment for this technology, so you're hoping its launch won't be far off. How will it facilitate the work of the police and other authorities?
We think the technique has a wide range of uses for the police. One of the immediate ones that springs to mind is roadside testing of individuals who may be driving under the influence of drugs. The technique could be used at the roadside to take a simple fingerprint, so you wouldn't need to take a blood sample or a urine sample or a saliva sample, do an analysis there and then that would give an indication as to whether that person had actually taken a legal drug and were under the influence.
What else can it be used for? Could it be used to test athletes, for example?
It could be used to test athletes. We think some of the other uses are perhaps related to things like border control at airports and seaports. If somebody, for example, has a bomb actually hidden within their body cavity, we think we'd be able to pick up the traces of that actually within their fingerprint sweat. We also think it has uses potentially within healthcare. There are other things in the fingerprint sweat that will give an indication as to say somebody may have a certain disease. And again, we could use that through the analysis of the fingerprint as part of a health screening.
Can the device get information from an old fingerprint, or do you have to use the actual finger for it to work?
From the tests we've done so far, we have looked at both fresh fingerprints taken from an individual directly, but also fingerprints that have been taken and been stored for many weeks. And we find that on the tests we've done so far, that we get as good results from the samples that have been stored as from those that are taken directly from an individual. So you could see the circumstance where the police may have some fingerprints from an unsolved crime scene from weeks or months or possibly even years, where we could look at those fingerprints, perhaps get some information about the individual that could be used to provide some intelligence to the police that might help them identify a suspect in an unsolved crime.
That was Paul Yates from Intelligent Fingerprinting in Norwich in the UK. Now let's get a roundup of what else has made the news in the last week with Zulfikar Abani.
Researchers at the University of Glasgow in Scotland are leading the world's biggest study on Parkinson's disease. To find better ways of diagnosing and treating the disease, the charity Parkinson's UK is looking for 3,000 volunteers who have the condition as well as their siblings. All have to be under 50 years old. Their responses for various treatments will then be monitored for up to 5 years. Parkinson's is a debilitating disease with symptoms such as tremors, mood changes, and speech problems. German physicists from the Max Planck Institute of Quantum Optics have created the first elementary quantum network. Quantum networks aim to exchange and store quantum information. Computers with that kind of network would be much more powerful and faster than existing networks. According to the journal Nature, where the research was published, this new type of network has two all-purpose nodes that can send, receive, and store quantum information. The nodes are linked by a fibre optic cable that carries it from one node to another on a single photon. It's only a prototype so far, but the physicists say it could eventually be used in computing or for wiretapping, for example. A staggering 30% of all internet traffic is pornography-related, according to a report by technology website Extreme Tech. The report says that the biggest porn site on the web, Xvideos, receives 4.4 billion page views and 350 million unique visits per month. Only the likes of Google and Facebook can keep up with those numbers. People also hang around for longer on porn sites. With news websites, it's between 3 and 6 minutes, but the average time spent on a porn site is somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes.
And now to the world of art. Yes, you're still listening to Spectrum. Occasionally, we stray into slightly alien territory on this show. This time, it's because of Julius von Bismarck. He's the winner of the first Prix Ars Electronica Collide at CERN Residency Award. The German artist was selected from 395 hopefuls from 40 countries. As the first artist in residence at CERN, he will spend 2 months in the vast complex, also home to the famous Large Hadron Collider. During this time, he'll be working alongside the world's top particle physicists and his mentor, American theoretical physicist James Wells. Danny Mitzman went to meet the artist and the scientist and discover more about what happens when art and science collide.
His brother's a physicist, so was his grandfather, and some of his past works have involved explorations of gravity. But Julius von Bismarck, CERN's first artist in residence, is like a foreign body in this gene pool of physicists.
Scientists from more than 100 nations are working at CERN on the Large Hadron Collider, the most powerful tool to study the first moments of the universe.
I worked a lot with technology, and I was always interested also in science, but I could never really interact with scientists because in my school there were no scientists. Like I'm in an art school. There are a lot of designers and artists, but not really scientists. But it's not so easy to actually meet real physicists. So now I'm hoping to get a lot of inspiration out of the time here.
4 huge detectors take snapshots of each collision.
And I don't even know what media I'm going to use for my next work. So that could be a technical work, that could be an image, it could be something even not involving any matter. I don't know yet. I'm not in a studio, I'm in an office. It's the first time in my life I really work in an office. But it's great because it changes how I work. And yeah, that change is really refreshing.
Is it inspiring you being in an office space?
Yeah, totally. And especially because this office is in CERN. So if I go to have a coffee and if I go and have lunch, I'm surrounded by scientists and I even hear what they're talking about on the other tables. And that's inspiring. And so the place where you are in is just changing how you think.
Do you actually go up to people and say, excuse me, I'm the artist in residence, can I listen to what you're talking about and join in the conversation?
No, that's more happening the other way around. Sometimes scientists come to me, are you the artist in residence? And then they speak to me because I'm too shy to just go to someone. But they know about me because I was on the CERN website. But sometimes it's just nice to be in the cafeteria and then sometimes you pick up some words of other table. But it's really inspiring to get those bits of real scientific discussions.
During his 2 months at CERN, Julius von Bismarck's being mentored by James Wells, a theoretical physicist and specialist in hidden worlds, the search for mysterious particles that don't respond like normal particles to any forces except gravity. As a scientist, he believes having an artist around is an exciting new collision challenge.
I think there's tremendous respect for artistic skill and the creativity in the art community. I don't believe that CERN would welcome an artist in residence program as enthusiastically as they are if it weren't for the fact that the entire community is behind art and artists. But there is a skepticism about other ways of looking at life. I think they get uncomfortable with the way some artists look at the world and the way they approach problems, and they see it as different than themselves. And it's a bit threatening because you wonder, am I missing out on life because I have this hyper-rational approach?
They try to understand what you are actually doing, your goal, and then they just don't get it. Like, what's the point of doing that? Like, why do you want to put that there? Like, that doesn't make sense. And like James said, they're rational, but there are different ways of being rational. And what is rational for an artist is something different than for a scientist.
Now the universe has become transparent.
At the beginning of his third week in residency, Julius says he's already learned a lot about physics and physicists. Part of why he's here is to disrupt, criticize, and challenge the theorists and experimentalists' notions of reality, and I wonder how he's doing so far.
As an artist, you go somewhere, then you analyze what's happening, and then, of course, one idea is to disrupt a bit what's happening, to challenge people to think different, do something that will change their way of thinking.
How are you challenging then?
I know already how to provoke people a bit.
Oh, do tell.
Because I'm not a scientist, so they're not getting angry with me if I ask stupid questions, but some stupid questions really provoke them to tell things they might not tell when you don't provoke them in that way.
For example?
Yeah, what always works is when you talk about, oh, why are you using so much money for this experiment? Can't you find a cheaper way to do this? And they are really annoyed, and then they are really defending what they are doing. Also, besides others, so for example, if you compare different experiments and you say, shouldn't that experiment get more money or something, then they really start to talk bad about the other experiments and make their own experiment much more important.
And in terms of the provocation that Julius has said he's particularly good at, has he been provoking and disrupting you so far?
He hasn't yet tried to make me angry.
Yet.
Yet, but maybe at some point he will, and then all sorts of things will come out, and then I will regret it. But so far he's been provoking indirectly.
For thousands of years, mankind has been wondering about these questions.
What can artists do for a scientist? And what can a scientist do for an artist? Certainly from the scientist point of view, the benefit of the artist is opening your mind, seeing different ways of approaching nature, different ways of approaching life, adding more humanity to what you do, thinking about the implications of what you do for the rest of your fellow humans and nature. I also believe it's a necessary engagement that artists should have with scientists and scientists should have with artists.
I totally agree with James about that. Maybe sometimes it's good to really put you in the place where you would like, that is most far away from your mindset, and then it's really opening up your mind.
For the next month and a half, Julius will continue to learn as much as he can about the people, the place, and of course the science at CERN. After that, he'll spend the final month of his residency at the Ars Electronica Center in Linz in Austria, creating his showpiece. He says he's excited, if a little worried, about people's expectations.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to make a work that is like combining art and science. That's really hard. Like in the end, I'm going to do a piece of art and it might be inspired from here, but maybe some people will also be disappointed. Like, so it's a hard job. The good thing about art, I don't have to please everyone. But of course, I would like to please the scientists here, because I'm getting so much from them, so I want to give something back.
Whether Julius von Bismarck's final result will create a big bang or a little fizzle is both artistic and scientific territory that's yet to be discovered. Danny Mitzman, Deutsche Welle Radio, Geneva.
11 million kilos. Imagine that as a pile of rubbish. Well, that's how much food Germans alone waste every year, according to a recent study. A large part of that is organic and made into compost, like the leftovers from the fruit and vegetable wholesale market in Stuttgart in southwest Germany. But soon anything from apples to herbs to asparagus can be turned into natural gas to power cars. A new plant will turn produce into gas, and next door people can fill up their cars. Kate Hersine reports from Stuttgart.
Today we have a lot of strawberries from Italy and Spain. Also, we get the first asparagus from Germany. Then we have a lot of oranges and mandarins, and also vegetables like lettuce and all the other kinds of salad.
That's Titel Steiger, the head of a busy fruit and vegetable trading company. He's one of hundreds of traders and farmers based at the Stuttgart Wholesalers Market, the third biggest of its kind in Germany. Not only are massive amounts of fruit and vegetables sold here, massive amounts of fruit and vegetables are also thrown away here. What happens to oranges, for example, that are bruised, or bananas that have gone soft? Where do you put them?
This is unsere grüne Tonne.
Okay, so this is your green waste bin here?
Yes.
All the things which are not good for selling, so we put all that in the green tonne.
You've got salad mainly, cauliflower, some paprika, and some herbs.
Salad, we usually have to sell it in 3 days. And after 3 days, we have to put it or to give it away. Perhaps we only have 2 days.
The Stuttgart market produces 2,000 tons of green waste a year. Currently, these food scraps are collected by the Stuttgart Council and turned into compost. In a few weeks' time, though, a percentage of the organic waste will be used for something else. It'll be tracked just across the road to a pilot biogas plant. There, the waste will be fermented to produce methane gas, which will be used in turn to power cars. I'm walking there with a person in charge of the new biogas plant, Dr. Ursula Schliessmann. She's an engineer at the German research organisation, the Fraunhofer Institute.
The idea of this demonstration project is to get the bio-waste out of the wholesale market, put it into the biogas plant and directly concentrate the methane, put it into the service station, and the cars can fill his tanks.
Exhaust emissions from cars driving on natural gas produce less carbon dioxide and almost no soot particles compared to cars powered by petrol or diesel. But natural gas is a fossil fuel and thus a limited resource. That's why researchers are looking at how they can best produce gas from renewable resources, such as fruit and vegetables.
Here we have the cutter, here we have the storage tanks, and here we have two reactors. This is the central part of the anaerobic digester.
In the plant's reactors, various microorganisms break down the food waste, generating biogas as they do so.
We reached in experiments before, in a small scale, that we need 8.5 days. And after that, we all have degraded in raw biogas. And the raw biogas contains methane up to 65%.
Fruit and vegetable scraps produce much more methane than other types of organic waste, such as animal manure and harvest byproducts. However, using the market waste does present a big challenge. As Karl Kübler, the head of the Stuttgart market, points out, the type of fruit and vegetable waste fluctuates wildly according to the season.
You have to imagine it like this. If it's melon season and then suddenly we have a cold spell, no one buys the melons. Then we have a huge quantity of melons that are thrown out all at once. These are the kinds of problems that the plant has difficulty with.
Dr. Schliessmann hopes that smaller biogas plants like this one can be dotted throughout cities. She says they can play an important role in the energy mix of the future.
The advantage of this kind of technology is that we can put it in the middle of a city where the people are living, because it's no smell and it's a closed system. Here's the place outside of the building where the service station will be placed.
When the plant officially starts at the end of April, the German car company Daimler will fill up test cars with different mixes of methane gas to find out what works best. One day, perhaps, the minivans and trucks arriving here at the Stuttgart Wholesalers Market will be able to fill up their gas tanks from produce that they once delivered. Kate Hersine, Stuttgart.
That's it from Spectrum this week. Don't forget you can listen to all the reports again online at dw.de. From me and the rest of the Spectrum team, Nigel Tandy and Helmut Schwieder, it's goodbye for now.